On these sort of centralized execution environments, what would happen if you went beyond them in a single system to look at multiple runtimes at a time, and how would we interoperate between them well? We looked at it, started out with just between two Java virtual machines, and then really what I focused on recently is how do we do it with lots of different languages? What does that mean? Why would you want to use that? And it's really to exploit sort of modern systems, hardware and software technology, virtualization, multiple processors, and cores. And so that's really all taken me to ask the question, well, now, if I can run really well on a single system, how can I run really well in the large on cluster systems, let's say, or multiple clusters in a distributed computing environment, still from the programming language perspective, right? Still from what dynamic compilation tools can we use? What kind of runtime do we have to look at? Do we need what kind of garbage collection? Is there information we can transfer from the operating system up? That makes sense? And really, I've done it in that exact kind of pursuits in the context of cloud computing. So what I thought I'd do is kind of tell you a little bit about cloud computing. I'm sure you've heard the term. Everyone has heard the term, or who has not? Anybody have not heard the term? Let's do it that way. Yeah, I figured. It's really one of these hyped areas. A lot of us work in hyped areas. You know, we're talking about transactional memory being very hot. Garbage collection was very hot in its day. Cloud computing is extremely hot, but you can... And there's benefits for working in a hot area. There's also huge disadvantages. And the big one is everyone thinks it's just a bunch of hype. And so we got to find sort of your way and communicate why the problems you are working on are important and interesting, but also why they are applicable in a larger term, on a larger perspective, sort of what impact can you have, and if you can impact something that's really exciting by the commercial sector as well as, you know, all of the... a lot of the academic sector, then you know you can have some good visibility and really have impact in terms of what you're contributing to science. Okay. So cloud computing in general is very an ambiguous term, a lot like a lot of terms we use in computer systems. Is you really have to know what the definition is from the person that you're getting the information from in order to understand what that perspective is. Cloud computing is one of these terms. It's, in my opinion, is defined as this: software systems for accessing easily and transparently very large scale CPUs, storage, and network resources remotely over a network. Okay? So as a service, as this term that's been coined for lots of things, for infrastructure, for platforms, for software, and that just means accessing infrastructure, platforms, or software over a network, and the systems on which they're running are highly scalable. So what you have is a bunch of very large companies with vast compute resources, storage resources, networking resources, Google, Amazon, Microsoft, commonly are using their data centers, these large-scale data centers, for their own uses, for their own applications, you know, search and data, massive data processing. Primarily. And what they found was they have an opportunity here to make some money from in the commercial sector, as well as to utilize these resources fully, by providing hooks into the services they use for their own internal stuff. Okay? And that's really the key thing to remember, is that the things that have evolved so far, and I'll point them out as we go, have really evolved from very specific uses in these large-scale data centers and providing an API to those user uses, those implementations, that you could use for programs. And then what you can do is you can write an application or a system, implement a system with applications in it, communicate to these resources through a set of web services, establish an agreement called an SLA, or a service level agreement, with the organization who owns the resources. You do not own these resources, right? You establish some SLA, which allows you to pay for those resources, and in turn get some guarantees about quality of service. Scalability primarily, and scalability is very specifically defined for each of these companies who provide this service. And I'll talk about those as we go. But when I say, oh, it's highly scalable, the first thing you should ask me is, what are you talking about? What are you scaling, right? Is it number of users? Is it, you know, number of processes that can run at one time? Those are very different answers. Amount of data you can move? Those are very different answers. The key thing here is you pay as you go. You only use a little bit, you only pay a little bit. Turns out this is so cheap that there is no way you could even have a small cluster that you had an administrator support that where that cluster amortized over time, your use of it, would cost you less than if you just use their resources. It is that cheap. So there's this incentive to use these remote resources instead of paying and administering your own, and you get this vast scale. Okay, so that's the other sort of attraction to this, on a rental basis, yeah.
They might not be related, but what is the relation between cloud computing and service-oriented architecture?
Yeah, let me get to that. So it's an evolution of service-oriented architectures, plus a lot of other things combined. The big thing is this customer the infrastructure based stuff is fully customer self service. So you are just given here's a processor, here's a storage resource, here's a network. You do with what you want. Build a Linux, you know, image, write your application in it. You have a lot more control in this environment for the infrastructure as a service. In addition, the resources are opaque. You know how many virtual machines you get because that's what you're paying for. How much storage you're getting? You have no idea where that is. You have no idea what the underlying technology is, how fast it is, how slow it is. You don't know what you really have underneath you. It's all opaque. Okay, that's really different. And another big thing is you only get a very small piece of the total resources at any one time. And that's sort of the things that have sort of differentiated it from the things that come before it. You know, I'm going to address that a little bit more in a second. There are three types of cloud computing, and I've alluded to a little bit of them, all three of them, just a little bit. Infrastructure as a service. This is really I would say the progenitor of this has really been Amazon, Amazon's web services. All the ideas, again, are a culmination of these past pieces of work, but the first one to really provide an infrastructure as a service where you pay as you go has been Amazon. This is EC2, Elastic Block Store, Simple Storage Service, and I'll explain those later. But the idea is you get the resources are completely isolated using virtualization, particularly Xen. So Xen got a huge boost because Amazon had chosen them for their virtualization layer. You deploy full system images. You are completely in charge. You've got to build your own, or you can download a Linux image that'll run over Xen, and you can populate it with whatever you want, right? Transparently, these images will move around. These instances will move around just to load balance and to make sure that Amazon can maintain the quality of service that it's trying to guarantee to its customers. If you don't get that quality of service, if you don't get the scalability, if the systems go down, something bad happens, they refund your money. The next layer above that is platform as a service. This is really where I've been focused. It is the language infrastructure level. It is a complete software stack. So instead of managing your own Linux box, your own Linux image, all you do is you write a Java or a Python app, and you have a set of APIs, library calls that you use, and you can then upload that application, and the library implementations of that API are Google's high-performance, you know, highly scalable implementations, or Microsoft's in terms of Azure and the .NET framework, right? Okay, so the isolation here is at the process level. They have some other isolation mechanisms, but a lot of it's proprietary. I don't know a whole lot of the underlying details. I can only guess. And again, the library support, the APIs is what I'll talk about today, are these very specialized, highly scalable systems for managing web services, really. There's also software as a service. This is the highest level. And this has really had a tremendous growth recently. Salesforce.com is really the biggest player in this field, but tons of startups are all, you know, jumping on board with the software as a service. The idea is the application lives on these remote resources, and you just use those applications through a web interface. The applications actually run. Now think about this, how this changes the software model. Okay, now you don't develop a piece of software and ship it to your users. You develop a piece of software, you optimize it like crazy on your own resources. Then your users come and use that application through a web interface. You write it once, you optimize it once, you're on site. You debug it, you can update it, you are in charge, right? It's a completely different model. It's great for maintenance and for reliability of software. It's also fantastic for keeping software proprietary. Think of Java, bytecode. I think one of you mentioned when I was talking about it earlier, Python. You're pretty much handing out source. Bytecode really is just source. You can decompile it. There's tons of great decompilers out there now that only hiccup on very small pieces of code that have been obfuscated. So what this does is you can write in any language you want, and you don't have to any longer give out your source. You can keep it locally, and people just use it. They can get some information. You might provide them with some tools, but then again, everything stays in-house. And so this is really appealing to the commercial sector. Now, I haven't really been focused on this. I've talked to a bunch of people who are interested in this, and I think there's lots of growth and there's lots of potential here, but primarily in the commercial sector. UCSB, my department, as a collaboration across multiple disciplines, you'll see why in a second, has really focused on infrastructure and platform. So let's talk about cloud fabrics today, and this kind of goes into your question. This is really not something new. I've had lots of slides where I say, it's really not something new. It's an evolution. It's an exploitation of something new, like technology that comes into play that you combine with other technologies that have existed, but you do it in a new way, or you do it for a new application domain, or you do it remotely for a proprietary set of resources. It's really successful today because of virtualization and multi-core hardware. Because that is lightning fast today, we have lots and lots of opportunities there. If we didn't have those two things, we wouldn't have anything else. All the software infrastructure, all of the technology in terms of the software is the result of recent advances in operating systems, programming language and runtime support, fault tolerance and distributed computing. All the quality of service stuff, everything we've sort of learned, this is sort of the culmination of it all. Again, huge uptake in the commercial sector. Yeah?
What is
elastic computing? Elastic computing is to use a set of resources and grow and shrink according to demand. Utility computing, again, is to use a set of resources like it's electricity. You use it as much as you need, so it pays you go kind of thing. Cluster, using cluster-based distributed computing, so message passing between clusters. And grid computing is this use of groups of resources together to solve some larger problem. A lot of people relate grid computing and cloud computing and argue, but it is quite different. In grid computing, you know what resources you're a high-performance programmer, probably, high-performance computing programmer, HPC. Or you use it for web services, but you know what resources you're going to. You optimize your program for those resources. When you get them all. You get a big old chunk of them. You know exactly what you're getting. Right? Here, you have no idea. You get virtual machines. Right? You don't know if you are having all the machines yourself or not. So the model's a little bit different. Public cloud. So the public clouds is this idea that you have these... someone else owns the resources, and you run your apps on it. That's called public clouds. It reduces the IT cost. That's why businesses love them. No administration overhead. Very easy to use. One of Google's they're a big proponent of this, of course. They will make money because Google App Engine is their product, and it's free now, or it's free up to a certain level, a number of resources. But they will charge a very small amount, and they do charge now. But just because it's so easy to use, they really are hoping to have a diverse user community, not just a bunch of computer scientists. Really. They are thinking much broader, and they want that because they want more diversity in the backgrounds of people who develop the next generation of apps. Right? If we have different perspectives, we may be able to really forward technology with some interesting products or interesting services. Right? So they're really a big... proponent of, let's make it as easy as possible for users to use, so that's why they really love Python. Again, broader user community. They offer high availability and extreme scale. Again, unlimited resources that there's no way we could ever replicate as academics, or even, that kind of scale just doesn't exist except at those companies. But why they are able to give you these availability and extreme scale guarantees that you pay for is because they severely constrain what you can do. Okay? So they say, they put on quotas. They say the number of CPU hours you use is going to be limited, as well as you have to pay for. Network bandwidth, memory, storage, all limited. There is a bound on what you can even pay for, right? And then at the platform level, like in the Google and the Microsoft domains, you're severely restricted in terms of what your apps can do. This is not just a general purpose Python app using the Django framework. It appears you can use like a little of the Django framework and a little of the Python libraries, but a lot of it is a sandbox and you can use very little of it. And the reason behind that is if they can constrain what you can do, then they can make estimations about how many resources you're going to use in a given period of time, and therefore it can make guarantees about where to put things and how to scale. So if you severely constrain the problem domain, you can do you can reason about the resources that are going to be used much easier, right? If you let anybody do anything, we're going to have a really hard time maintaining scale. Google is extremely afraid of this because it's on their resources that they use for really important jobs like indexing and PageRank and Google Earth data crunching. Okay, same resources. Your software is running on the same resources. So they have to make sure you're really constrained, and they're scared to death of allowing you to do much more. So people are begging for it. Even Java was a scary thing, right? Java virtual machines are much bigger footprints than Python, and they've recently gone with Java, but again, libraries are very constrained. So therefore, yeah.
Not allowed, like a library.
Oh yeah, I'm gonna give you the whole list.
So by constraining you, yeah. So just let me get there, and I'll show you it all. So by constraining you, what they've allowed you to do, or what they think people will like to use these systems for, is really web services. So model view controllers, front end web page, some sort of interactive back end database, and some controller that links the two together. Okay, so very simple model, database focused, database oriented. That's really where all the work happens. And so they're going to give you very specialized versions of the database and sort of the intelligence between your web page and the database. Okay, so cloudy issues. First of all, a lot of us have a cluster. A lot of universities have a cluster. You as students have access to clusters. A lot of commercial institutions have clusters. In fact, there's some that have vast resources. You know, it's kind of interesting. You know, a lot of these benefits, these highly scalable, easy to use technologies, would also be useful and interesting and cool to mess with on your own clusters. On-premise clusters is what these are called. So on-premise is distinguished from public clouds. Public clouds is Google and Amazon's resources that are proprietary. On-premises is yours. Are yours. Okay, so first of all, a lot of the features that cloud computing offers, services and all this, transparency, scalability, you know, interesting scheduling techniques, they would be useful for our own systems. It'd be nice to be able to use them. Secondly, there's a lot of issues with using someone else's proprietary, even though it's highly scalable equipment. The big one that's holding everybody up is privacy. You are now uploading your code and data to someone else's machines. If you are running a company, that sends shivers down your spine. Everything is proprietary. Everything is, and startup companies could depend on whether you win or lose, whether you succeed or fail. So people are very scared. It's private data. It could be your medical records. Hospitals today can't afford their own technology, can't afford system administrator. This is a great solution for them. However, it's pretty scary. Sure, there's encryption and security, but there's also lots of security holes. Even worse, when the government wants that data and they force the company to give it up, they only have to go to one place. They don't have to go to these individual places. They have to go to one. They got to go to Google. Sure, Google may resist and say, no, no, no. But you never know. It makes you a little nervous if you're on the paranoid side of things. Vendor lock-in. Think about this. If you write a Google App Engine app or a Microsoft Azure app, and build a big one for your enterprise, for your company, what you have done is you've programmed against these APIs. Those APIs don't exist anywhere else, right? So if you want to change, if you want to build that functionality on someone else's resources, say, You want to go from Google's to Microsoft Azure. Good luck. You have no support. You have to rewrite it from scratch. Okay? This is called vendor lock-in. People are heavily against this. And so they've really pressed these vendors to say, you know, why don't you open this up? Why don't you tell us what these APIs look like? Why don't you provide some of this to the community? And the answer is absolutely not. There's also potential for hybrid solutions. This data, this privacy, the security issues. If you had this ability to use some of your cluster resources, which you have anyway, and you have IT staff to maintain, you got to develop, you got to do something. You're going to have, if you're a computer in the computer industry, you're going to have some computers. And then you could use those, and then if you really needed this extreme scale, you don't need it all the time. You need it on demand. So when you need that extreme scale, you could fall in to Amazon or Google. Right? And then, if you didn't need it, or if you were really tight on resources that month and money that month, you could use only your cluster and have no scale. Right? You could choose. So this hybrid solution is really appealing. Question is, how do you do it? Right? Google, Amazon, Microsoft, not interested in hybrid solutions. Just use theirs. Right? So there's startup companies that are trying to do this for you, but it's not really working, because if it works in Google, it's not going to work on this cluster. If it works in Amazon, it's not going to work in this cluster, because the APIs are Amazon's and Google's and Microsoft's. All right, so I'm kind of repeating myself there. I guess the last point is important. So I'll tell you exactly what the constraints are, but because we're so restricted, I mean, web services are great. You know, for a room of, you know, brilliant people like you, you're probably thinking more interesting apps. Probably thinking, you know, there's other things we can do with a computer that's more than web services, right? So if we didn't have all these constraints on what we could do that are really specialized for web services, then maybe we could think about other application domains, right? Public clouds are opaque, open APIs. The APIs are available. They just give you a description of what they do. And then the implementations are closed. They're proprietary. They're very highly tuned, highly scalable, high performance. We don't know what those look like. We can only run on them and kind of experience it with our programs to get a feel for what's happening. In addition, what's your program doing? You put it out there in Google's resources. Oh, it looks good. It's running great. They're charging you for your storage and your bandwidth and your CPU usage. How much are you using? Are you sure you're using that much? I mean, if you have Amazon, you could put in instrumentation and profiling and all that, making sure that everybody's, you know, doing what they said they're doing in terms of the SLA, that's what you're paying for. But you don't necessarily know. In fact, how do we know ahead of time? If I'm going to put my application up there, how am I going to know how much it's going to cost me in the end? I have to establish this early to get my boss to okay it so that I could use it, right? Hard to know. How are you going to debug? Right? They do give you sort of local platforms to try, these SDKs, but they're not the real implementations. And just like we said last time I spoke with you, the debug version is never really the optimized version. Bugs in one don't necessarily show themselves in the other. So you have this problem. And of course, I think that we should do something more interesting than web services. All right, so that's what we've been focused on. As I said, it's sort of been an evolution of my work. I really wanted more collaboration. I think David made some really good points this morning about, you know, key ways of sort of advancing your career. But it's really about being happy, I think, too. At first, you think, oh, you just be smart enough to figure out how to solve these hard problems. But it really is choosing collaboration and choosing the right problem. And so I think this is really just that. It took me a while. You know, I've been at Santa Barbara for 8 years now, and I'm just kind of coming into this. And so this is really an effort to be more collaborative within computer science. You know, I definitely would like to go outside of that, but I'd really at first just like to talk with the operating system folks, or the peer-to-peer folks, or the database folks. And you have that, and you have some of that in your departments when you're a professor, but it's not like you work on a project together. And I think for students and for faculty alike, that's a real opportunity. You really get cross-pollinization of ideas. And it's really exciting, because you don't feel like you're in it alone. So this is an effort in my department to try to bring this idea of cloud computing to on-premise clusters. Now, there's lots of ways of doing that. We could come up with our own APIs. right? And we all could research it and work on it. But what we really wanted to do is bring something that was really similar to the commercial sector. Because by doing that, I'm getting ahead of myself. So that's what we want. We want to bring them to on-premise clusters. Again, ease of use, right? You want high performance and scalability still on the back end. But again, you want anybody to be able to use this without even thinking, you know, initially. And you want the runtime and the compilers and the operating system schedulers and the distributed system platforms and the databases to extract the performance that you need. So that's where we started. So of course, we wanted to solve some interesting problems. These are the few that I was most excited about. I've mentioned them already. Novel application domains, services, technologies. What does the next generation look like? How can we know until we can have a platform that lets us try it, right? Well, you know, computer science research is about failing. We have to have be able to investigate to know what's next. Hybrid cloud solutions, support technologies. What is the tools, data management, databases? What does that look like? You know, everyone says, you know, Google's Bigtable database is the way to go. All the database community has only looked at relational-based databases. There's this huge fight between which is right. And again, if we could investigate some of these things in together in a single system, we could get some interesting answers, I think. Customization, adaptation opportunities. All right, so what we want to do then, so that's what our goal is. That's our goal. This is what we want to accomplish. And the way we're going to do it then is emulating real cloud systems. Okay, so we're going to take the infrastructure as a service and the platform as a service, and we're going to implement it by emulating the functionality and make it all open source. Okay, so what this does is this helps with the lock-in problem. If you can run Amazon stuff on your own cluster or you can run Google stuff on your own cluster, that means that you could decide whether you want to run in Google or not. Right? You can run in any cloud system that implements this open source piece of API, right? So that kind of helps there, but really it's about you know, answering some interesting research problems, providing the community with a way to look inside, to say, how is this really working? What's really going on in there? You know, why? And we really want to leverage existing technology. We don't want to reinvent the wheel. We want to use open source software as much as we can. Not a replacement for any public cloud service. There's no way we'll ever scale like Google and Amazon, ever. We're not claiming to, we're not competing with them. That's not our focus. Our focus is to understand and to think about what's next for Google and for Amazon and to contribute back to the community. Okay, so my work then has been focused on the middle piece, the platform, because that's the language piece. What we've done is we've implemented the Google API. We could have chosen Microsoft Azure, but I was more interested in actually Python. I didn't know it before I started this, and there was a huge uptake with it, and they have a lot of functionality now, and the language has really evolved. And I wanted to, and I'm a Linux person, so I thought staying in a Linux domain rather than moving to a .NET domain, which really requires Windows. I mean, there's Mono and other runtimes for .NET and for Linux, but they're not quite as advanced. And if I'm working in research on something that's kind of low on the totem pole, then my contributions are unclear. It's unclear if I make, you know, 10x performance improvement if I'm using the slowest thing on the block. Right, so I really wanted to be with what was sort of what everyone was using in industry. And so what we do is we take all of the Google's API and then we implement those ourselves with open source software and our own code, of course. Google App Engine apps can be written in Python or Java. Python came first. Java was more recent. We have Python supported. Java we have supported in-house only, not released, because it's hard and to get it to work well yet. One interesting thing I want to point out here, why I'm doing this. One, it's really different. It's an open source project. I'm putting it out into the community. It will give me users. I've never had that before. I think that's really interesting. I get to put out research products out there to really get users to use and give me feedback on. If they suck, I will know very quickly. It is lightning fast out there. You know, I also release it as open source so that people contribute. You know, my team can't do it alone. I would love for people to contribute, so I really want that. So I wanted those two experiences. I also wanted real applications. What you find in programming language empirical research today is everyone uses these benchmarks to evaluate their techniques. And there's good sets of benchmarks out there, and they're decent, but they're not really representative. You know, they're not real applications. One of my goals was to have an infrastructure where there is, for Google App Engine, there are real applications just sitting out there, just that you can download. You can download everyone else's Google App Engine apps if they've made them available. So I can, anything I do, I could and improve upon, I could use other people's real applications, full web services, to see where my stuff is in terms of the performance. So it gives me this real, I don't know, this real example of how the system is being exercised for these different programs. Now, as I change the system to move out of web services, then I'm going to have more trouble. But I'm hoping, because I'm giving it to the open source community, that I'll have more people writing applications for it, and I'll get payback that way too. Okay, so Google App Engine has a set of APIs. These are they. The big one is the data store API. It consists of Bigtable with a MapReduce backend. I'll talk a little bit about this. It sits over a distributed file system. So lots of technologies here. I'll talk a little bit about these two in particular. Memcache is an in-memory data store, right? This is really a simple interface, just a put, get, delete interface, really simple. You don't have an interface to MapReduce. Google uses it for lots of things internally, but they only allow you to use it for indexing of your tables implicitly. You don't have access to it, but I'll explain what looks like. Memcache in memory. Authentication, if you have your users come and hit your web page, when you have them log in, it'll use the Google accounts for you. It's really nice. So that authentication API goes to the Google backend. Again, by the way, these are highly, highly scalable implementations on Google's resources. Mail is interfaced with Gmail, so you have that out of the box. URL fetch, any kind of communication you want to do has to be over HTTP or HTTPS. You can upload images. They're not dynamic. You can't create them on the fly, anything like that. You got to upload them with your app, but you have an image API. And now recently, you have this task queue thing. This is kind of interesting, because now, instead of only being able to respond to web requests for your work, you can have actually little background jobs. These are still constrained, but you can actually do a little more interesting things with this API. So I'm going to talk about the underlying technologies just briefly. First one's Bigtable. This is a key value store, schema free, very simple API, very simple implementation. They wanted to keep it very simple because they wanted to just exploit the behavior, heavy reads behavior of the way they were using accessing their data. This is a non-relational implementation, so there's no table joins and things like that. Not complex. Makes it really easy to scale, right? Also is highly available. They have multiple copies, so you have replication and as well, so you have consistency across those and availability of your data. Lots of copies of it in case pieces of it goes down. This backend integrates with MapReduce, which I'll talk about in a second, for computational manipulation of the data. And there's open source implementations of Bigtable. There's a paper about it if you're interested. Open source implementations are HBase and Hypertable. This is in Java. This is in C++. And that's going to come and be more interesting later. Okay, so this is a master-slave model. You have a single master and multiple slaves for replication. And to make sure you have fault tolerance, you have shadow masters. So if a master goes down, you have one that's in the background that can just come up immediately. There's automatic load balancing for read optimization or for operations. There's a lock system called Chubby that they use to manipulate the locking system and use of these tables in the system. All this is written up in paper, so you can actually read about from Google what they're doing internally. They don't give you numbers or anything that's that exciting, but they definitely describe how they're using their systems internally. They don't give you any kind of code, but they give you the descriptions, which is nice. Low-level transaction semantics in the database. The next big piece is MapReduce. Again, Google uses this heavily internally, but only provides a little bit of access to it through indexing of your Google App Engine apps. This has been around forever. MapReduce is not new. In fact, a lot of the parallel programming people were really annoyed when Google came out with this paper because they're like, you know, we've been doing this forever. But Google's system is specialized, and they discuss the specialization. So if you're interested in it, that paper is actually quite nice. The origins come from the functional language community, Lisp. And ML had this for a long time. It's used heavily for lots of tasks inside Google, as I said, but PageRank and the Google Earth crunching, it's all done with MapReduce. It's very simple in that it only is for embarrassingly parallel computations. If you have communication at all, it's not going to work. Right? People have tried it for things that communicate even a little bit, and you don't get the performance. So you get extreme scale through embarrassing the parallel operations. I'll explain how that works. It's pretty straightforward. This is, you know, again, not very complex. And so if you have a problem that matches this, then they give you a nice API that you just define your mappers and reducers, and it just makes it really simple to use. So pretty much you just specify your mappers and your reducers, and all your data is just split up. You don't have any control over this in Google. In Google, they can dictate how big these pieces are, how many mappers they're going to spawn at once. All the mappers do the same kind of job. They have some sort of intermediate phase that collects the information, potentially sorts it, and then assigns it to the workers. Through a distributed data store that's highly optimized for this purpose. You have the reducers, which then take the data from the mappers and accumulate it. What usually happens is you have a lot of data coming in, and it's computing some sort of reduction over that data. So what you usually see, there's some numbers reported in the MapReduce paper where they have a ton of data coming in, terabytes and terabytes of data, but really what's coming out is very small amounts of data. So kind of gives you some insight to what they're doing. There are open source versions of this. Hadoop is an open source version of MapReduce written in Java. Highly specialized, lots of companies have picked up Hadoop to specialize it. You can get it in Amazon's EC2 now. You can have it's not really highly optimized. I was really shocked. I thought they would have done a little bit more work on that. But they have an interface to it, so you can assign your mappers and reducers and deploy it on Amazon's resources. But Hadoop's is actually, the Hadoop one is actually the one used in Amazon. It's just a little bit, that changed a little bit. There's other implementations of this that are available. There's some interesting work on GPUs using MapReduce that you might want to check out. FPGAs, interesting stuff. Okay, so let's talk about how you use this. So you write a program, very simple program, doesn't have that much code, and this will work pretty much out of the box. Let's say you write it in Python, you download an SDK, software development kit. You test your program. Your program will run over that SDK. If it runs over the SDK, it'll run on Google's resources. That SDK has no scalability, right? That there's a distributed database technology, high-performance database technology. It's a flat file. Really simple, dumb implementation, just to see if you have the correct functionality and are working with the APIs correctly before you upload to Google's resources. You really have no sense of the performance. You have some sense of how much data you're going to be pushing and pulling out of there, but it's hard to sort of evaluate what your costs are going to be from that. And then once you upload it to Google, you just tar up your file. It has a little configuration file that you upload with it. In a particular location, Google deploys it on its resources. When it executes in the sandbox, highly constrained, highly restricted. Only a subset of the language APIs can be employed, both for Python and for Java. Here's some of the restrictions. This is a good chunk of them. There's no threading, no sub-processing. You cannot fork, you cannot spawn threads. There are no system calls, which means there is no writes to the file system. Okay, think about this. It kind of makes sense from a web services perspective, but in most of our other programs, we use local files. No writes, reads only to the static files you have uploaded. the only storage you have is this key value store, which means if you want to pump a bunch of data in, or actually really the example is you want to have your web service and your users use this backend database, and then after a while you want to download all that data back to your home resource, let's say. Okay, you want to see what happened, you want to see what data is there, and but you can only do that in a, with puts and gets, right? You can do it in a series of puts and gets, but it's like 10 of them. And you can only move, you know, 10 items at a time. Do I even say? Yeah, I think it's like 10 items at a time in and out of this data store. So if you're trying to pull a terabyte of data, it's going to take you a long time, and you're being charged for every one of those transactions. So you're, there's disincentive for you to not to pull things out of the system. HTTPS and is the only form of communication that you have at your for you to, for your application. I've already said that. Limit on response times. When you get a web page hit and you have the Python code respond to that, you only get 30 seconds maximum, or Google will kill you. Kill that request. That user will just have to retry. They are thinking, they're talking about restricting that further to something at ridiculous like 10 seconds. All right, so this means you're not doing a whole lot, right? So it's nice, it's good for Google scalability, but it's not so great for doing anything interesting in terms of other applications. The number of tasks, even if they were within that 10-second boundary, the number of tasks that you can handle at once in a period of time, the rate at which you handle requests is limited. Is restricted. After you go past that rate, they just cut you off. Sometimes they'll just cut off your entire program just because. My students did just a bunch of performance evaluations using Grindr to hit our Google App Engine app to see what the performance looked like. And as soon as they sensed that, it was within 20 minutes. We got good data for 20 minutes, and then they completely cut us off. And they usually cut off for us for 24 hours. I don't think it's just us. I think it's any of you if you do it too. The request rate I talked about, task frequency, the number of background tasks. On top of that, there's the enforced quotas of the amount of bandwidth, that data you're shipping, CPU load, number of requests per second. Files are all static. They have to be uploaded. The size of the file is restricted. The size of your program is restricted. Lots of restrictions. But it's great because that allows them to give you the scalability. But where is a sweet spot? And very interesting question is, what would happen if we reduced some of these constraints? Where would things fall off? So what we did, we just took the SDK, the software development kit, that Google has open sourced, and we chopped off the back end, all of the silly APIs that are very simple, we just detached, and then we plugged in all of our own. We actually just have a plug-in interface. So not only could you plug in your own database, but you can plug in any database. So we looked at a bunch of them, HBase and Hypertable, which are the open source versions of Bigtable, two different languages, might be interesting to see. Cassandra and Voldemort are peer-to-peer implementations of this flat file key value pair, very interesting. Got peer-to-peer folks on my team, got database folks on my team, very interested in this question. We hooked up a relational database, right? Now we have the opportunity to say which is better. Which is better for which applications, right? So there's lots of things you can investigate here. We hook up MapReduce, and we give you an interface to it. What are your mappers and reducers? How do you want us to deploy them, right? It's your cluster. What do you want to do with it, right? Where does it make sense to do something like that? Our authentication is decoupled from Google accounts, of course, because we don't have access to them. So, but what's nice about that is we can use any authentication. So where I'm going to go is in multiple cloud layers, I could use the authentication system of whatever's below me, the other cloud layers. Right? I could use the authentication system of the virtualization system that's below me. All of our component communication is SSL, so we do have some encryption and some basic security there. We use IP tables to make sure that only our components are only able to intercommunicate with each other. No one else can get in. So that's pretty much it. The way it works is there's four components. there's a front end, a load balancer called the ALB, the AppScale Load Balancer. And it's where you upload your applications to. It's where your administrator deploys a system from. It is the brains and the proxy for load balancing across the App Engine app you know, the App Engine servers. We call them the app servers. Okay, so that is our single point of failure. We're working on having hot swapping of it right now. But everything else is all replicated and highly available. If it goes down, we will bring it up. We monitor heartbeat, all of our profiling stuff we've used in the past. Makes perfect sense in this domain. And it's all in different systems, so we just kind of coordinate through the ALB, and we know when things go up and down. All of the App Engine front ends execute on the App Engine app servers, and you can have as many as you want. You can grow and shrink these if you want. These are very lightweight in Python. In Java, not so lightweight. So there's trade-offs, right? Really interesting performance things to investigate there in terms of growing and shrinking according to demand, even in the web services domain, right? And then beyond. Database master, or if it's a peer-to-peer system, just multiple, as many as you want. So if the database becomes the bottleneck, you can make that grow. Our system that we deploy is one big package. So you can put it in an image, and then you just have to tell the image what its job is. And it'll become an ALB or an AS or a DB. You can put things on the same node. You can say, hey, you're an ALB and a DBM, right? You're a DBS and an AS. This actually works out pretty well for a peer-to-peer system because a lot of the local stuff that's just read-only can be highly optimized to go to your local store if you co-locate your database slave with one of the app servers. But there's all kinds of combinations of things. We have a heartbeat mechanism that goes throughout the system to just make sure things are up. If they're not, or if they're not responding, we just kill them off and start them again. State free, right? So we have lots of opportunities for making this available plus, you know, scalable. Let's see. The users then, once you have started, so first you start this AppScale Cloud, you then upload Google App Engine apps to it as many as you want, not just one. Right, AppScale is a cloud. You upload Google apps to it, and then your users access go initially through the ALB to see which front end they get, and it's just based on load balancing. Once they get one, they hang on to it. If that one should go down, they'll be rerouted automatically to the ALB to get a new AS. So that's all set up. Our interface has been modeled after, if you've anybody has messed with EC2, is modeled after the EC2 tools. This is Amazon's EC2 tools. So we just kind of named them AppScale plus the EC2 tools. And you can deploy the system with run instances. You can say, hey, what's running? How many nodes am I using? How many apps are running? You can upload apps this way. You can remove apps this way. This is not really released right now, but we have it working. And then you can just kill the whole system if you want. The system deploys, and this is really why we're doing it as a collaboration. It deploys over Amazon's EC2, so I can run it in another cloud. Cloud fabrics on top of each other, so we can see how they interact. What's the profile look like that for that? You know, how does it interact with the lower level systems? Eucalyptus is an open source EC2 implementation from UCSB. This is our project, our collaborative project with another group at UCSB, which I'll tell you about. You can just deploy it over anything, Xen, KVM, VMware, not quite yet. We're actually working with VMware to get it into their next generation cloud. Linux clusters if you want them, but I think it's more interesting as a cloud fabric. Here's when my students hammered Google and got some results. The results are really terrible, but this was a long time ago. Our results are much better, but I had no data for you by the time I came. The black ones are Google. That's nice. That nice angle means scale. What this is the number of transactions that are completed over time. This is number of web requests. We're just running Grindr against it. Grindr's a really nice tool that allows you to run a bunch of operations per user and introduce users until you saturate the system. So what we have is over time, we're introducing three new users every 5 seconds, and each one of those has a series of transactions. It could be anywhere from one or two operations to 10 or 12. Just to show you some differences, this application here doesn't do any kind of writing. It just reads from the database and it does some operations locally in the client box. And so it's really highly scalable in Google. This one here is a guestbook signature. So every time you sign, you get the entire guestbook back so you can see who else is signed. That's shipping tons of data back and forth, so even Google has trouble scaling when you start to introduce tons and tons of users. Our numbers are in white, and this is a static implementation, so I only have 4 nodes. And as I introduce users, what happens is I scale fine. These are just kind of problems. I scale fine until I saturate the system, and then everything just kind of tails off. This guy makes it here and tails off. And the reason is because I have a static system. Google is growing on demand. I don't have that implemented in my system right now. We have the base functionality to do that. We just have to decide what the model is. Under what load do we grow? Under what load do we shrink? How do we avoid thrashing? What happens if it's just a burst of activity? How do I know? You know, and it takes a long time to start these things up under virtualization. So you have a very interesting performance model that you're using to estimate how you should grow and shrink.
When you say it's static, have you made any assumption about the number of nodes in your system, or it can grow?
Our number is 4: 1 head node and 3 app servers. So I just did it for the numbers. So if you want 6, you just say minus n 6. Right now it's minus n defaults to 4. You can make it as many as you want. And what it does is one head node, and then an app server and a slave on all the n minus 1. Database masters with the head node.
Then there is no limitation on the number of nodes?
No, absolutely not. And I want to grow it dynamic. I want to do it automatically. You can have access. You have access. You can download this and put your number in there and grow the cluster as big as you want, but it's static. You select a number. What I'd like is to be able to sense who's loaded when and to grow that node as needed, right? And that's really interesting when we talk about clouds, because if you're executing an EC2, you have negotiated an SLA. You have a contract with Amazon to say, I'm going to use this many resources. I want this many VMs. My software is going to have to renegotiate those SLAs on the fly. What does that mean? How are you going to do that? You know, I think that's going to be a really interesting. Are you going to allow a piece of software to negotiate your SLAs for you? Interesting research questions. Yeah. Just a number of transactions. A little confusing because this is time, but every 5 seconds I introduce 3 more users hitting the web page, and each user has a set of transactions for that particular app that they execute just in a tight loop. So tons of transactions.
How can you have fewer transactions at a later time? Is it accumulated transactions or transactions per second?
Per 5 seconds. So I'm scaling until I can't scale anymore. So then I just, grind to a halt. Yeah. Fault tolerance only in our heartbeats. So very simple fault tolerance. I sit there and just ask, hey, are you? My head node says, hey, are you alive? Hey, are you alive? And if I don't get a response, I just send a kill request for that component and restart it. The fault tolerance, this is my single point of failure for the released version, but in-house we have shadow ALBs that sit behind here. And if this guy went down, the database master could restart it, or another node could restart it. And then we have a protocol for making sure that happens. But that's all we got. That's as far as we got. So it stays up pretty well because of that. We do see things go down and machines get unplugged. And we've actually tested that, and that it is resilient to that kind of thing for the back end. Well, the database, so we choose one database per app scale. So if the master goes down in the master slave version, so HBase and Hypertable, it'll bring down the database. And so you may lose your data. We have a backing store for persistence. The ALB will notice the database is no longer responding, and it'll restart it, and it'll bring in the persistent data. You may lose stuff, but there's no consistency in this. There's hardly any. It's very limited consistency that Google offers you anyway.
So,
no. You could look. You could put that in with this. The components are very, very simple, and the API is well defined. We could look at all kinds of different things. All right. So, So where we're going, we're working on Java. It seems like it would be straightforward, but the thing is, the Python SDK was released as Python. The Java SDK is released as bytecode. As you know, bytecode is a very compact implementation of the source, and it's actually not so fun to read. It's hard to know what the programmer intended. We can use it, it's open source, we can do anything we want with it, but it just gets in our way. You know, I've asked them, Google has sponsored me for this, has paid us to do this. And I would like it if they would just give me the Java source, but no, they want us to just have access to what everyone else has access and see what we can do with it. So we'll figure it out, but the first version of Java was easy to decompile. I was very excited. And then 2 weeks ago, they released the next version, and it's not decompilable. It has weird exception handling, and that's what's hanging us up. So we'll figure it out. Just take a little bit longer. It's not released, but we do have it. Everyone wants it. Everyone I talk to, I mean, there's lots of companies who want this to compete with Google or something, I don't know, but they really want the Java version. It's fascinating. I want to do this dynamic growth and shrinking. That's what we're working on internally. This performance monitoring, as you probably have perceived from my talks, I like profiling and making it run really fast and trying to figure out what the behavior is without introducing too much overhead. I also want to help with debugging. I think there's really interesting distributed debugging problems here. Different languages, how do you debug across languages? We have a really nice set of well-defined APIs. We use Thrift for inter-language operation, and those APIs are really clean. There might be some opportunities there for some interesting debugging or performance profiling in a very lightweight way. I forgot to mention our system is pretty much every modern language you could imagine. Ruby on Rails is our front end. The app servers are either Java or Python. We do a lot of Python internally. The databases come in every form you want, C++, Java. Is that it? C++, Java. Those are the two big ones. And then, so we have to interoperate between them. I want to reduce the constraints. Remember I gave you a whole huge list of the things that are constrained. I'm never going to scale like Google anyway, right? Your local cluster, even if you had, 1,000 nodes, is still not going to scale to what Google can. So maybe you could, use some more functionality, parallelism and concurrency, or more MapReduce stuff. Maybe you're interested in scaling on different triggers. Maybe you don't care about, a web front end and user request. Maybe you care about something else. You should be able to dictate that. These sandbox restrictions, the fact that you can't talk to the local file system is really restrictive. What happens when we allow that locally? Anyway, so we're looking at that. Fault tolerance, other groups are interested in. The database team is really interested in different database technologies. They're heavily invested in the relational model, so they're really working on showing that MySQL will do better than the others. And of course, I mentioned earlier, I really want to look at the other cloud fabrics, primarily Eucalyptus. Eucalyptus is another project at UCSB. Rich Wolski leads it. It's an infrastructure as a service, so it sits below AppScale. It's got a huge uptake on the orders of, thousands and thousands of downloads and uses. It's actually being deployed with Ubuntu. There's Linux distributions all around that are using it now. And so it's a web services-based implementation of the EC2 infrastructure, or the AWS interface. There are three primary ones. There's the Elastic Compute Cloud, which is just the Xen virtualized systems that you hand an image to, and it creates an instance for you, and it gives you a set of tools to manipulate that instance. Gives you a set of security APIs for firewall-based stuff and security groups. Amazon also provides you with S3, a simple storage solution. This is a put-get interface, very simple. You can't move a lot of data very quickly. You're charged for it like you are for Google. That wasn't sufficient, so recently they came out with the Elastic Block Store. This is just like a big old disk that you mount in an instance, and then you use it like a file system, and then when you detach, when you shut down, that it all remains persistent. Okay, you pay for it, but it all remains persistent. You can move things in between the two. You can only mount it to one instance at a time, so you don't have parallelism here, right? So high-performance computing really wants a distributed file system so that it can use sharing and do sharing and synchronization via the file system. But there's nothing like that yet.
Now, with S3, you're able to access it without going to the compute layer. With EDS, are you also able to do the same?
Yes, just as a straight API, you can use it directly. Tools, right scale, there's some numbers for you for how much you pay. Again, way cheaper than even buying the, you know, a decent processor today. Okay, so I'm running kind of short of time, so I'm just going to skip some of this. But it's all online. You can have any of this. Read about it. Eucalyptus was a project, which was just research, but it got just tremendous uptake that they've spun it off as a startup company, primarily to support their users. There's just way too many of them to have a bunch of researchers support them. The group comes from sort of a software development background, so they've managed really large projects before. So they had a lot of programmers, so it wasn't like they were all just students leaving the university. A lot of the students just finished up and left, or there was the programmers that went. So it's now a commercial entity, it supports its open source community by tailoring the implementation of the Eucalyptus system to your resources. If you're a company, you're interested in this, it can optimize it for your system. Yeah.
I don't.
We have a lot of companies who are interested in it, and so I'm working that angle to try to get them to give me money so I can have programmers, but I just have research students working on this.
So, the practical question is, how do you deal with a copyright issue it's not really a copyright issue.
Yeah, copyright is UC.
It's an issue if I have an outside developer who contributes a lot, how can I go and publish?
Yes, so that's a huge issue. And
just getting it to be open source for the University of California was an enormous feat. Enormous. The fact that this is free BSD even, so there's no restriction. You can use it for anything you want. So that's a big step. Second step is, how do I handle contributions? The way we're going to do it is, I don't handle them now, right? We're still early in the project. But as soon as I get it to a stable point, Ubuntu is going to pick it up. And they will put it in their distribution, and then they'll use their system, their infrastructure to allow contributions from their community. Debian will also do something like this. And so there's all that is joint. He has to agree to the BSD license if he's going to contribute. So he's got to be okay with that. He could also just take it and do it himself. Make money off it. Take the system. It runs. You can just one button, almost one button install. Pretty simple. And then he can make money off of that if he wants to. If he wants to contribute research-wise, yes, we look for collaborators all the time. We are working on that. So they don't have to release it. We don't have to put it out. You could take this at your institution, do your project, write your paper with us or without us, and not release it. If you want to contribute it back, then you could get your paper out and then contribute it. It's tough, though. There's a lot of issues when you're... I thought this would be easy, and it is not. So what I'm interested in and why I presented it to you, one, I think it's interesting. You should know that it exists. In terms of Eucalyptus. But what's interesting here, I think, in terms of research, is this ability to look across these layers. Again, one of my themes. I was looking at JVMs interacting with the operating system. Well, this is a much larger scale. It is, applications interacting with the JVM and potentially Python and Ruby interacting with the operating system, interacting with our scheduling system, our infrastructure, interacting with Linux and Eucalyptus. And there's a lot of redundant work. We're all doing some of the same things in different places. And can we coordinate this better? Can we lose perhaps some of the isolation benefits? Remember my shared memory stuff? A little bit of isolation loss at the result, at the benefit of much better performance. And so that's really where I think the research is, looking at where these cloud fabrics, where the boundary is between them. Could an EC2 provide all of the services of a platform or not? you know, and why? And where do you want to focus your energy? So I think there's a lot of really interesting questions here, and that'll be the focus from here forward. Again, it's been since about September that we've been working on this. We have multiple releases. It's available. It runs in a static setup with where you specify the number of nodes. We do have a bunch of users, hundreds of users that we support, that we interact with. And that's all been engineering, right? This is a huge engineering investment. So that's a little bit different. You don't usually find that. Research is about producing your own prototypes, getting your papers out, and moving on, right? This is very different. So my grad students had to be okay with the fact that they would do a lot of engineering. Now, I felt a feeling, because eucalyptus came before us, and they had a lot of visibility, that the students wouldn't have an issue. But, you know, we're going to eventually be able to publish a lot because we'll have a framework from which we build. But I just wanted to bring this out because programming systems, and if you're a systems person in programming language today, you're going to have more and more of this. One, we really want to put things out as open source. I really think it's important. I think we have an obligation as researchers to put our stuff out. Maybe not support it, but put it out there. Let other people use it. Let other people press on it. Let other people find bugs. Let other people find mistakes. It's scary, right? But it is so important to forward science. And I feel really strongly about that. I think that there's so many great techniques out there, and all from everything from theory all the way to, you know, really hardcore systems. And yet, when I want to compare against somebody else, another paper, and I call them up and I say, hey, can I get your stuff? No, it's not quite ready. It's kind of ugly, and it's not going to work, and I don't know, and it only runs for these programs, and you got to kind of do this and you know, dance around and hold your hands up. And I'm like, it's okay. I can do that. No, sorry. I can't tell you how many times that's happened to me. I can't tell you. And what sucks is that then I have to go, my students have to go and implement these things again, right? And it's just a waste of time. And I know it's not high-quality software, but we all are writing not high-quality software. We're not in industry. I encourage you to share. I encourage you to at least consider sharing. Because if you're brave enough to write a paper and present your ideas, you should be brave enough to contribute your techniques out there. If they can't use them, oh well. You know, if someone can't take them forward, oh well. At least you make the attempt, right? Because me rewriting your code is not going to do any of us any good. Because what am I going to do? I'm going to do it from my perspective. Who says I did it the right way? Who says I did it exactly like you did? I showed 3x speed up. Is that real? Does that mean something? If I don't use your system, I don't know. Anyway, wanted to kind of throw that out there. So I think that, these have all things been boiling in me while I've been a professor, and I think, you know, this effort has sort of been an experiment to see how that goes. Now, this is much bigger than what I would recommend, you know, you guys taking on, but because we have a lot of people, but, you know, considering some of these things is really good. So these are my PhD students. I have a much larger group. I might usually have 4 or 5 PhD students at a time. And I just wanted to show you that even though this is a huge engineering adventure, that there are thesis problems, thesis size problems, bigger than thesis, multi-thesis size problems that are in here. And each student kind of figures out what's interesting to him, what's compelling, or to her, although I have no hers right now, and figures out where they want to contribute. And so our infrastructure gives that opportunity. So you've seen some of the cross-language stuff. I have a profiling person. I have an HPC person that's interested in these new domains for cloud computing. I have a guy who loves sensor networks and is thinking about, what do we do? Can we make a cloud over, you know, resource-constrained devices, you know, my phone? What does that mean? How do I have data intensive? What happens if I have sensors bringing in all this data into the cloud? What does that mean? Where do I store it? Do I pay on a put and get basis? Doesn't sound right, right? So he's going to investigate those kind of questions. So you can do a lot of things with it, and it's really up to the student to kind of figure out what's most compelling. That's how I kind of do things. Okay, I think that's it. That's it. Any questions? Yeah.
Is the
my infrastructure comparable to this? Oh, middleware.
Yep.
Middleware, I sort of see I mean, in general, middleware, right? In general, I sort of see it as sort of services, components that are isolated, that are autonomous, kind of sit there and lots of things request them. This is more a runtime. I see this as more of a runtime. Now, I have background components my runtimes interact with, but I think the interesting things when you're thinking about the next generation of application domains is going to be the runtime for me, for my group. So compared to middleware, it's... Yeah, I mean, there's definitely some overlap, right? I mean, a lot of this is similar in motivation, you know, to provide libraries, really, to access the underlying resources efficiently in different ways, or to access novel services. So I think that the motivation's similar, and there's probably techniques we could bring to bear on it, but I've probably pretty much been focused on the runtime. Other questions? Okay, well, I'm happy to talk to you afterwards. Thank you very much.